Chapter 2. When his post-chaise reached the outskirts of Petersfield, Stephen Maturin opened his bag and drew out a square bottle. He looked at it with an anxious longing, but reflecting that in spite of his present craving, by his own rules the crisis itself was to be faced without allies of any kind, he lowered the glass and flung it out of the window. The bottle struck a stone rather than the grassy bank, exploding like a small grenade and covering the road with tincture of laudanum. The postboy turned at the sound, but meeting his passenger's pale eyes, fixed upon him in a cold, inimical stare, he feigned interest in a passing tilbury, calling out to its driver that the knacker's yard was only a quarter of a mile along the road, first turning on the left if he wanted to get rid of his cattle. At Godalming, however, where the horses were changed, he told his colleague to look out for the cove in the shay, a rum cove that might have a fit on you, or throw up quantities of blood like the gent at Kingston. And then he would have to clean up the mess. The new postboy said in that case he would certainly keep an eye on the party, no move should escape him. Yet as they drove along it came to the postboy that all the vigilance in the world couldn't prevent the gentleman from throwing up quantities of blood if so inclined, and he was pleased when Stephen bade him stop at an apothecary's shop in Guildford. The gentleman was no doubt laying in some physic that would set him up for the rest of the journey. In fact, the gentleman and the apothecary were searching the shelves for a jar with a neck wide enough to admit the hands that Stephen carried in his handkerchief. It was found at last, filled, and topped up with the best rectified spirits of wine. And then Stephen said, "While I'm here, I might as well take a pint of the alcoholic tincture of laudanum." This bottle he slipped into his greatcoat pocket, carrying the jar naked back to the chaise, so that all the postboy saw was the grey hands with their bluish nails, brilliantly clear in the fine new spirits. He mounted without a word, and his emotion communicating itself to the horses, they flew along the London Road, through Ripley and Kingston, across Putney Heath, through the Vauxhall Turnpike, across London Bridge, and so to an inn called the Grapes, in the Liberty of the Savoy, where Stephen always kept a room, at such a pace that the landlady cried out, "Oh, Doctor, I never look for you this hour and more. Your supper's not even put down to the fire. Will you take a bowl of soup, sir, to stay you after your journey? A nice bowl of soup, and then the veal, the moment it's enough." "No, Mrs. Broad," said Stephen, "I shall just shift my clothes, and then I must go out again. Lucy, my dear, be so good as to take the small little bag upstairs. I shall carry the jar. Postboy, here is for your trouble." The Grapes were used to Dr. Maturin and his ways. One more jar was neither here nor there. Indeed, it was rather welcome than not, the hanged man's thumb being one of the luckiest things a house can hold. 10 times luckier than the rope itself, and in this case there were 2 of them. The jar then caused no surprise. But Stephen's reappearance in a fashionable bottle-green coat and powdered hair left them speechless. They looked at him shyly, staring, yet not wishing to stare. He was perfectly unconscious of their gaze, however, and stepped into his hackney coach without a word.
"You wouldn't say he was the same gentleman," said Mrs. Broad.
"Perhaps he's going to a wedding," said Lucy,
clutching her bosom.
"One of them weddings by licence, in a drawing-room."
"No doubt there is a lady in the case," said Mrs. Broad. "Whoever saw such a dusty gentleman come out so fine without there was a lady in the case? Still, I wish I'd taken the price ticket of his cravat. But I didn't dare. No, not even after all these years."
Stephen told the man to set him down in the Haymarket, saying he would walk the rest of the way.
He had, in fact, the best part of an hour to spare, so he walked slowly through St. James's Market in the general direction of Hyde Park Corner, and took half a dozen turns round St. James's Square. At this end of the town his clothes excited no attention, except from the women who shared the streets with him, a great number of them in arcades, shop doorways and porticos, some of them fierce, angry, scornful creatures with their bosoms laid out, the caterers to special tastes, others so young, mere slips, that it was a wonder they should find customers even in so huge a city. One assured him she would give him a good breakfast with sausages if he came with her, and although he civilly declined her offer on the grounds that he was going to see his sweetheart, the idea of food so spurred his mind that he walked into one of the alleys haunted by footmen behind St. James's Street and bought a mutton pie of an old lady with a glowing brazier to eat in his hand as he walked. He moved on, carrying it, until he reached Almack's, where they were giving a ball. Here he paused in the little crowd that was watching the carriages arrive. He took a bite or two, but his appetite, a purely theoretical appetite, was gone. He offered the pie to a tall black dog that belonged to a neighbouring club and that was watching by his side. The dog sniffed it, looked up into his face with an embarrassed air, licked its lips and turned away. A dwarfish boy said, "I'll eat it for you, Governor, if you like." "May it profit you," said Stephen, walking off. Through to the Green Park, an expanse lit faintly by the horned moon in which couples could vaguely be seen, and single waiting figures among the nearer trees. Stephen was not ordinarily a timid man, but the park had seen many murders recently, and tonight he had a greater value for his life than usual. In fact, his heart, though admonished and kept down by experience on the one side and prudence, or superstition on the other, was beating like a boy's. He cut up to Piccadilly and walked down the hill to Clarges Street. Number 7 was a large house let out in apartments with a porter common to them all, so when he knocked at the door it opened. "Is Mrs. Villiers at home?" he asked in a harsh, formal tone that betrayed the most eager expectation. "Mrs. Villiers? No, sir, she don't live here any more," said the porter in an absolute, decided, rejecting voice. And he made as though to close the door. "In that case," said Stephen, walking quickly in, "I wish to see the lady of the house." The lady of the house was very willing to see him. She had, indeed, been hovering behind a curtained glass door in the hall, peering through. But she was by no means so inclined to give him any information. She knew nothing about it. Such a thing had never happened in her house before. No such person as a Bow Street officer had ever crossed its threshold. She'd always taken the greatest pains to ensure that all the inmates of the house were above suspicion, and she'd never countenanced the least irregularity. The whole neighbourhood, the whole congregation of St. James's, all the tradesmen, could testify that Mrs. Moon had never allowed the least irregularity. In the following discourse, which dealt with the difficulties of maintaining the highest reputation, it seemed that there was some question of unpaid bills. Stephen said that any inadvertence in this respect would be remedied directly, and that he would take it upon himself to look into any unsettled account. He was Mrs. Villiers' medical adviser, naming himself, and the medical adviser to several members of her family. He was perfectly authorised to do so. "Dr. Maturin," cried Mrs. Moon, "there's a letter for a gentleman of that name. I'll fetch it." She brought a single sheet, folded, sealed, and addressed in that well-known hand, together with a number of bills, from her desk, tied in a row with a piece of ribbon. Stephen put the letter into his pocket and looked at the accounts. He had never suspected Diana of moderation, had never supposed that she would live within her income nor within any other income. But even so, some of the items startled him. "Ass's milk?" he said. "Mrs. Villiers is not in a consumption, ma'am, and even if she were, which God forbid, here is more ass's milk than a regiment could drink in a month."
"It's not for drinking, sir," said Mrs. Moon. "Some ladies like it to bathe in for their complexions."
"Not that I ever saw a lady less in need of ass's milk than Mrs. Villiers." "Well, now, ma'am," said Stephen after a while, writing down the sums and drawing a line under them, "perhaps you would be so good as to give me a brief account of how Mrs. Villiers came to leave so abruptly, for the apartments, I know, were taken until Michaelmas." Mrs. Moon's account was neither brief nor particularly coherent, but it appeared that a gentleman, accompanied by several strong-looking attendants, had asked for Mrs. Villiers. On being told that she could not receive a gentleman unknown to her, he had walked upstairs, ordering the porter to stay where he was, in the name of the law. The attendants produced truncheons with little crowns on them, and no one dared move. She would never have known they were Bow Street runners, but for some of them guarding the back door and coming into the kitchen. They told the servants what they were, and they said the gentleman was a messenger from the Secretary of State's office, or something like that, something in the government line. High words were heard upstairs, and presently the gentleman and two of the runners led Mrs. Villiers and her French waiting woman down and into a coach. They were very polite, but firm, and they desired Mrs. Villiers not to speak to Mrs. Moon or anyone else, and they locked her door behind them. Then the gentleman came back with two clerks, and they took away a quantity of papers. Nobody could tell what to make of it, and then, on the Thursday, Madame Gratipoux, the waiting woman, suddenly came back and packed up their things. She spoke no English, but Mrs. Moon thought she could make out something about America. Most unfortunately, Mrs. Moon was not at home later that afternoon, when Mrs. Villiers came in with a gentleman she called Mr. Johnson. An American gentleman, by his old-fashioned, twangling way of speaking through his nose, though very well dressed. It seemed that she was uncommonly cheerful, laughed a great deal, gave a turn about her apartments to see that everything was packed, took a dish of tea, tipped the servants handsomely, left this note for Dr. Maturin, and so stepped into a coach and four, never to be seen again. Had said nothing of her destination, and the servants didn't like to ask, she being such a high lady and apt to fly out at the least impertinence or liberty, though otherwise esteemed by all. A most open-handed lady. Stephen thanked her, and gave her a draft for the total sum, observing that he never carried so considerable an amount in gold. "No, indeed," said Mrs. Moon, "that would be the height of imprudence. Not 3 days since, and in this very street, a gentleman was robbed of £14 in his watch not long after sunset. Shall William call a chair for you, sir, or a coach? It's as black as pitch outside." "I beg your pardon?" said Stephen, whose mind was far away.
"Should you not like a coach, sir? It's as black as pitch outside."
It was also as black as pitch inside. He knew that the letter in his pocket contained farewells, his dismission, and the ruin of his hopes. "I believe not," he said. "I have only a few steps to go."
These steps took him to a coffee-house on the corner of Bolton Street. A very few steps, as he had said. Yet what a quantity of thoughts formed in his mind before he pushed the door, sat down, and called for coffee. Thoughts, ideas, recollections forming infinitely faster than the words that could, however inadequately, have expressed them, and tracing the history of his long connection with Diana Villiers.
a relationship made up of a wide variety of miseries interspersed with rare intervals of shining happiness, but one that he had hoped until tonight to bring to a successful end. Yet just as his mind had been too cautious to admit full confidence in his success, so now it was unwilling to see the proof of total failure. He placed the letter on the table and stared at it a while, until it was opened, the letter might still contain a rendezvous. It might still be a letter that fulfilled his hopes. Eventually he broke the seal. Maturin, I am using you abominably once again, although this time it is not altogether my fault. A most unfortunate thing has happened that I am not at leisure to explain, but it appears that a friend of mine has behaved most indiscreetly. So much so that I've been molested by a gang of wretches, of thief-takers, who searched all my few belongings and my papers and questioned me for hours on end. What crime I'm supposed to have committed, I cannot tell. But now that I'm at liberty, I am determined to return to America at once. Mr. Johnson is here, and he's seen to the arrangements. I was too hasty in my resentment, I see. I should never have flown back to England like a simple, passionate, headstrong girl. These legal matters. And they are going better. Call for patience and deliberation. I shall not see you again, Stephen. Forgive me, but it would not answer. Think of me kindly, for your friendship is very dear to me. D.V. In a brief flare of rebellion, anger, and frustration, he thought of his enormous expense of spirit these last few weeks, of the mounting hope that he'd indulged and fostered in spite of his judgment, and of their frequently violent disagreements. But the flame died, leaving not so much an active sorrow as a black and wordless desolation. When he was walking down the street to the coffee house, his eye, long accustomed to such things, had automatically taken notice of the two men following him. They were still there when he came out, but he was utterly indifferent to their presence. They preserved him, however, from an ugly encounter in the Green Park, where he wandered among the trees in a deep abstraction, his feet slowly guiding him eastwards to his inn, where he sank straight into a sleep as dull and deep as lead. He was spared the slow waking and reconstruction of the day before by Abel the Boots, thundering at the door with the news that there was a messenger who would take no denial, an official messenger who must put his letter into the doctor's hands. "Let him come up," said Stephen. It was the briefest note, requesting, or rather requiring, Stephen's presence at the Admiralty at 8:30 rather than at the appointed time of 4. The tone was unusual. "Is there an answer, sir?" asked the messenger. "There is," said Stephen, and he wrote it with an equally cold formality. "Dr. Maturin presents his compliments to Admiral Sivright and will wait upon him at 8:30 this morning." At 9:15 the Admiral was still waiting for Dr. Maturin, and indeed at 9:00 itself, for Stephen, hurrying across the parade, had met the former Chief of Naval Intelligence, Sir Joseph Blaine, a keen entomologist and a sure friend, who had just come from an early meeting at the Cabinet Office. They had a hasty word, for Stephen was already late, contracted to meet later in the day, and so parted, Stephen to keep his appointment and Sir Joseph to walk in St. James's Park. "Hey, hey, Dr. Maturin," cried the Admiral as he came into the room. "What the devil's all this? The Home Office people have picked up a couple of trollops that spend their time gathering information.
and they found your name in their papers.
I do not understand you, sir, said Stephen, looking coldly at the Admiral. This was the first time he'd seen him without the actual head of the department, Mr. Warren.
Well, now, said the sailor, I shall not beat about the bush. There are these two women, a Mrs. Wogan and a Mrs. Villiers. The Secretary of State's office has had its eye on them for some time, particularly on Wogan. Connections with some dubious characters among the royalist Frenchmen over here, and with American agents. At last they decided to act, and upon my word, it was high time. In Wogan's house they found some very surprising papers indeed. Many of them sent undercover to Villiers and passed on by her. And in Villiers' lodgings they found a number of letters, including these.
He opened a folder, and Stephen saw his own handwriting.
Well, there you are, said the Admiral, having waited in vain for Stephen to speak. I've laid all my cards on the table, fair and square. The Home Office insist upon an explanation. What am I to tell them?
One card is missing, said Stephen. How does it come about that the Home Office should apply to you for information? Am I to understand that my character, that the nature of my activities, has been divulged to a third party without my knowledge, against my express understanding with this department, against all the laws of sound intelligence? Stephen's intelligence work was of prime importance to him. He hated the entire Napoleonic tyranny with the most passionate loathing. And he knew, quite objectively, that he'd been able to give it some of the shrewdest blows it had ever received in this line of combat. He also knew the strange diversity of the various British intelligence services and the shocking, amateurish permeability of some of them, an insecurity that might only too easily put an end to his usefulness and his life. What he did not know, however, for his mind was dull that morning, was that the Admiral was lying. Mrs. Wogan had possessed herself, among other things, of some naval papers through a junior civil lord of the Admiralty. The Home Office had therefore sent the evidence to the Admiral, and the Admiral it was who required the explanation. His bluff, frank approach had imposed upon the diminished Maturin, who felt a red glow of anger burning up his apathy, rage at the apparent betrayal of his identity. "Upon my soul," said Stephen in a stronger voice, "it is I who must do the insisting. I desire you to tell me directly how it happens that the Secretary of State's people come to take notice of my name to you." The Admiral was puzzled to come off handsomely, and in the hope of drowning the question he adopted a more mollifying tone and said, "First, let me tell you of the steps that have been taken. All the leaks have been plugged, you may be sure of that. We interrogated the women separately, and Warren soon extracted enough to hang Wogan out of hand. But she has some very respectable, or at least some very influential, protectors. She's a remarkably fine woman. And in view of that, and the undesirability of a trial, and her voluntary production of some useful names, we struck a bargain. She pleads guilty to a charge that will mean her being sent over the water no more. We could have brought any number of capital charges, including attempted murder since she shot the wig off the messenger's head, but we decided to play it quiet. As for Villiers, the other one, we've decided not to proceed. Her explanation that she regarded the passing on of the letters as a mere friendly act, that she looked upon them as an intrigue on the part of Wogan with a married man, was hard to break down. And then her having become an American citizen raised grave legal difficulties. Government wants no further complications with the Americans at this stage of the war. Our pressing of men out of their ships is bad enough without our pressing their women too. And in fact, she may have been innocent. Looking at her, it seemed to me that her plea of helping in an amour was very likely, very much in character. She stood up for herself amazingly,
an even finer woman than Wogan, straight as an arrow, glaring at us like a wildcat, flushed with anger, blaggarding the Home Office man like a trooper. Lovely bosom trembling. I came in for a couple of broadsides. Wish there'd been more. Amorous intrigues. You are impertinent, sir. You forget yourself. I insist upon your answering my question instead of indulging yourself in this blackguardly manner. In the pleasures of his warm and luscious imagination, the Admiral had indeed forgotten himself. But these words brought him violently back to the present. He turned pale, and half rising from his seat, he cried, "Let me remind you, Dr. Maturin, that there is such a thing as discipline in this service. And let me remind you, sir," said Stephen, "that there is such a thing as respect for one's word. And furthermore, I have to observe that your manner of speaking of this lady would be gross in a libidinous potboy. In your mouth it's offensive to the highest degree. Bread and blood, sir, I've pulled a man's nose for less. Good day to you, sir. You know where to find me." He walked out of the room, collided with a clerk who was in the act of opening the door, and thrust past him into the corridor. "Send for a file of marines," roared the Admiral, now scarlet in the face. "Yes, sir," said the clerk. "Here is Sir Joseph to know whether Dr. Maturin is still within. The marines directly, sir." Leaving by the little green confidential door that gave onto the park, Stephen felt his anger die away as weariness came down on him like a pall, extinguishing the fire and with it all concern. Yet he'd not walked eastwards a quarter of a mile before he became aware that his knees and hands were trembling and that his nerves jangled intolerably as though they'd been flayed. He walked faster towards the grapes and the square bottle on his mantel shelf. Mrs. Broad, taking the sun at her door, saw him at the far end of the street. She read his face when he was still quite a long way off, and as he turned in she called out in her fat, cheerful voice, "You're just in time for a late breakfast, sir. Now, pray go in and sit in the parlour. There's a pure fire, drawing suite. Your letters are upon the table. Lucy will fetch you the paper, and the coffee will be up this directly minute. You could do with your breakfast a day, sir, I'm sure, going out so early on an empty stomach in the streets, so damp." He made some objection, but no, he might not go upstairs. His room was being turned out. There were pails and brooms that he might trip on in the dark. So there he sat, staring at the fire, until the scent of fresh brewed coffee filled the room and he turned his chair to the table. His post consisted of the syphilitic preceptor with the author's compliments and the philosophical transactions. After two strong cups that quelled the trembling, he automatically ate what Lucy set before him, the whole of his attention being set upon a paper by Humphrey Davy on the electricity of the torpedo fish. "How I honour that man," he murmured, taking up another chop. And there was that quack Salter Mellows again with his pernicious theory that consumption was caused by an excess of oxygen. He read the specious nonsense through to confound the arguments one by one. "Haven't I already ate a chop?" he asked, seeing the chafing dish renewed.
"It was only a little one, sir," said Lucy, laying another upon his plate. "Mrs. Broad says there's nothing like a chop for strengthening the blood, but it must be et up while it's hot."
She spoke kindly but firmly, as to one who was not quite exactly. Mrs. Broad and she knew that he had eaten nothing on his journey, that he had taken neither supper nor breakfast, and that he had lain in his damp shirt. Deep in toast and marmalade, he demolished Mellows root and branch. and noticing the indignation with which his hand had underlined the whole claptrap peroration, he observed, "I am not dead." "Sir Joseph Blaine to see you, sir, if you're at leisure," said Mrs. Broad, pleased that Dr. Maturin should have such a respectable friend. Stephen rose, set a chair at the fireside for Sir Joseph, offered him a cup of coffee and said, "You all come from the Admiral, I call it." "Yes," said Sir Joseph, "but as a peacemaker, I hope and trust. My dear Maturin, you handled him very severely, did you not?"
"I did," said Stephen, "and it will give me all the pleasure in the world to handle him more severely still whenever he chooses and on whatever ground. I have been expecting to receive his friends ever since I returned, but perhaps he's such a poltroon as to intend placing me under arrest. It wouldn't surprise me. I heard him call out something to that effect. In his heated state he might have done anything. He is perhaps more suited for the physical and for the intellectual side of these duties. And, as you know, it was never contemplated that he should exercise..." "What was Mr. Warren thinking of to leave such an affair to him? I beg pardon for interrupting you."
"He's sick. He's most surprisingly sick. You wouldn't recognize him."
"What ails Mr. Warren?"
"Most shocking stroke of the palsy. His laundress, he has chambers in the temple, found him at the bottom of the stairs. No speech left, and his right arm and leg quite paralysed. He was let blood, but they say it was too late, and hold out little hope." They were both heartily grieved for Mr. Warren, their sound, though humdrum, colleague. In this immediate context, however, it was apparent to both that his stroke must result in greater power for Admiral Sivright. After a pause, Sir Joseph said, "It was a mercy that I stepped into the Admiralty when I did. I had forgotten to tell you that the entomologists hold an extraordinary meeting tonight. I found the Admiral in a high-wrought state of passion. I left him quiet, uneasy, and as near to admitting himself in the wrong as it's possible for a man of his rank in the service. I represented to him that, in the first place, you were a purely voluntary ally, our most valuable ally, and in no way his subordinate in our department, that your entirely unremunerated work, carried out at very great risk to yourself, had enabled us to accomplish wonders. I enumerated a few of them, together with some of the injuries you've received. I stated that Mrs. Villers was a lady of the most respectable family and connections, the object of your..." He hesitated and looked anxiously at Stephen's expressionless face before continuing. "Of your respectful admiration for a considerable number of years, and no new acquaintance, as he supposed, that Lord Melville had described you as being worth the ship of the line to us any day of the week, a figure that I had ventured to dispute on the grounds that no single ship of the line, no, not even a first rate, could have dealt with the Spanish treasure frigates in the year 4, and that if by his handling of this admittedly difficult affair, Sivright had offended you to such a pitch that we were to be deprived of your services, then I made no sort of doubt that the First Lord would call for a report, and that this report would pass through my hands. For in confidence I may tell you that my retirement has proved somewhat hypothetical. I attend certain meetings in an advisory capacity almost every week, and there have been flattering proposals that I should accept an office with remarkably extensive powers. Sivright is aware of this. He will apologise if you so desire."
"No, no. I've no wish to humiliate him at all. It's always a wretched policy in any case. But it will be difficult for us to meet with any great appearance of cordiality."
So you do not fly off? You do not abandon us? Said Sir Joseph, shaking Stephen by the hand. Well, I'm heartily glad of it. It's like you, Maturin. I do not, said Stephen. Yet, as you know very well, without us a perfect understanding, our work cannot be done. How much longer is the Admiral to be with us?
For the best part of a year, said Sir Joseph, with the unuttered addition, if I don't sink him first.
Stephen nodded, and after a while he said, certainly I was vexed by his blundering attempt at manipulating me. The guileless sea-dog lulling a suspected double agent by telling him what steps have been taken for our love. That I should be tempted to be gulled with such sad, archaic stuff. It wouldn't have deceived a child of moderate intelligence. He spoke of his own mere motion, did he not? The alleged Home Office with so much primitive naval cunning. Sir Joseph sighed and nodded. Of course, said Stephen, a moment's reflection would have told me that. I cannot conceive how my wits came to desert me so, but the dear knows they've been wandering these many days. That unpardonable error with Gomez's reports. Stephen had left them in a hackney coach, as Sir Joseph knew very well. The classic lapse of an overtired, overworked agent.
They were recovered within 24 hours, the seals unbroken, he said. No harm was done. But it is true that you're not in form. I told poor Warren that the Vigo trip was too much for any man. Immediately after Paris. My dear Maturin, you are knocked up. You must forgive me for saying so, but you're quite knocked up. As a friend, I see you better than you see yourself. Your face has fallen away. Your eyes are sunk. You're a wretched colour. I do beg you'll seek advice.
Certainly my health is but indifferent, said Stephen, tapping his liver. I should never have flown out upon the Admiral had I been in the full possession of my faculties. I'm engaged upon a course of physic that allows me to carry on from day to day, but it is a Judas draught, and although I can stop the moment I please, it may play me an ugly trick. I suspect it of having clouded my judgment in a case where I lost my patient, and that weighs upon me cruelly.
Stephen very rarely confided in any man, but he had a great liking and respect for Sir Joseph, and now, in his pain, he said,
tell me, Blaine, just how far was Diana Villiers involved in this affair? You know the importance I attach. You know the nature of my concern.
I wish with all my heart I could make a clear-cut reply, but in all honesty I can give you no more than my impression. I think Mrs. Wogan did impose upon her to a large extent, but Mrs. Villiers is no fool, and a clandestine correspondence rarely assumes the form of foolscap documents 40 pages long. And then the precipitate departure. Chaise and four all night and day to Bristol. A 6-oared boat, and the rowers promised £20 a head to overtake the Sans Souci lying wind-bound in Lundy Roads, gives some colour to the notion of an uneasy conscience. Yet I'm inclined to think that the haste was the fact of Mr. Johnson, moved by a purely personal motive. Not that, as an American, he might not also be interested in information of value to his own country, though we've not established any connection whatsoever between him and Mrs. Wogan, apart from this perhaps fortuitous common acquaintance with Mrs. Villiers, and, of course, a common interest in America. But at all events, it is the United States that have benefited from these activities, not France. Mrs. Wogan was their Aphrabane. Their Aphrabane, he repeated, finding no response.
Aphrabane? The lewd woman that wrote plays in the last age? Said Stephen at last.
No, no. There you're out for once, Maturin.
said Sir Joseph with great satisfaction. "You've fallen into the vulgar error. As to her morals, I've nothing to say, but she was, first and foremost, an intelligence agent. I had some of her Antwerp reports in my hands not a week since, when we were looking through the Privy Council files, and they were brilliant, Maturin, brilliant. For intelligence, there is nothing like a keen-witted, handsome woman. She told us that De Ruyter was coming to burn our ships. It's true that we did nothing about it, and the ships were burned, but the report itself was a masterpiece of precision. Yes, yes. In the long pause that followed, Stephen considered Sir Joseph as he sat there musing by the fire, his fine, kindly face more like that of a country gentleman than of an official who had spent most of his life behind a desk, set in an amiable expression. And it occurred to him that somewhere in that keen, capacious mind, a thought was forming. If Maturin is, in fact, reaching the end of his usefulness, we had better get him out of the way before he makes some costly mistake. The thought would no doubt be tempered with genuine regard, friendship and humanity, even by gratitude. It would probably contain a clause to the effect that Maturin might yet recover, and that in his powers, his connections, and his unrivalled knowledge of the situation in his own particular sphere might be put to service. But as things stood with regard to many factors, including the position of the Admiralty, the thought, even without any qualification, would be a reasonable and indeed proper thought in the official part of Sir Joseph's mind. A well-run intelligence service must have its system of dealing with those who were past their best, or who had fallen by the wayside, and who yet knew too much. A knacker's yard run with more or less brutality according to the nature of the chief, or at least a temporary limbo. Sir Joseph felt the pale eye upon him, and it was with a certain uneasiness that he returned to Aphra Bain. Yes, she was a brilliant agent, brilliant. And we might call Mrs. Wogan the Bane of Philadelphia. She too turns an elegant verse, and she writes a pretty play. Letters are as good a shield as natural philosophy, perhaps even better. But unlike Mrs. Bane, she has been caught, and she is to be packed off on the first ship bound for New Holland, lucky not to be hanged. I never like to see a woman hanged, do you, Maturin? But I was forgetting. All is grist to your grisly mill, and you have your female subjects too. She's not to be hanged, because the DFC, as our Admiral put it, has made interest for her. It seems they were bedfellows not long since. For the same reason, she is to be treated with certain égard. A corner to herself aboard, perhaps a woman, and no servitude when she arrives at Botany Bay, there to spend the rest of her days. Botany Bay. What a goal for a naturalist, if not for an adventuress. Maturin, you need, you deserve, a break, a holiday to set you up. Why do not you accompany this ship? To keep your hand in, you can plumb the lady's mind. It contains a vast deal more than was revealed to us, of that I'm very sure. And what she has to say may resolve your doubts about Mrs. Villars. To make my suggestion more tempting, I may observe that the ship in question is to be commanded by your friend Aubrey. Though he don't yet know this part of his duty, the Leopard, for the Leopard is her name, was already under orders for Botany Bay to deal with the unfortunate Mr. Bligh, of whose predicament you're aware. When she's done this, and has delivered Mrs. Wogan, together with some people we shall add as a blind, she is to join our force in the East Indies, where, with your spirits quite recovered, you will be of the utmost service. Pray do consider it, Maturin. Stephen's longing
temporarily allayed by food, had returned with even greater force. He left the parlour for his bedroom and his draught. And returning, he said, "You're Mrs. Wogan, now. You speak of her as a second Aphra Behn, and therefore as a woman of shining parts. Perhaps I was going a little far. I should have added qualifications for time and place. The American's intelligence is but an infant plant. You'll remember the ingenuous young man that came with their Mr. J. And native shrewdness, even where it exists, is no substitute for some 100 years of practice. Yet, even so, this young woman had been well tutored. She knew what questions to ask, and she learnt many of the answers. I was surprised to find that there was no French connection. None, at least, that we could fix upon. But my comparison really doesn't hold, for whereas the Mrs. Behn I meet in our files shows a most remarkable sagacity and a grasp of the situation that would do honour to any politician, Mrs. Wogan seems to me a somewhat simple lady at bottom, relying upon intuition and dash whenever she is required to go beyond her plain instruction, rather than upon any considerable fund of knowledge. Please to describe her. She's between 25 and 30, but she still retains her bloom. Black hair, blue eyes, about 5'8", but looks taller since she stands so straight. Magnificent carriage of her head. A slight but undeniable figure, though these things, you know, can be improved by stuffing. A thoroughly genteel air, nothing bold or flaunting. Writes like a cat, with every third word underlined, and cannot spell. Speaks excellent French, however, and sets a horse to admiration. No other education that can be detected.
You might almost be describing Mrs. Villars, said Stephen with a painful smile.
Yes, indeed. I was so struck by the likeness that I wondered whether there might be some relationship. But it appears there is none. The details of her birth escaped my mind for the moment, but they're all in the files, and I shall see that you have them. No relationship, I believe, yet there is indeed a striking resemblance. He might have added that in Mrs. Wogan's case, too, there was a hopeless lover, a young man who hung on the borders of her life, a young man so peripheral that he'd been set free. Those who took him up found no hint of guilty knowledge, and it was thought better to let him go. Sir Joseph retained only a recollection of the deep unhappiness and the somewhat unusual name of Michael Herapath. Yet when I speak of her apparent simplicity, he went on, I may be one of that numerous company of men who've been deceived by women. There is more in this than we know at present, and the skein is well worth the untangling. As I say, it would keep your hand in Maturin, and it might even yield a jewel. Pray do consider of it. During his journey down to Hampshire, Stephen turned it over in his mind, but only with the surface of his mind, the rest being taken up with longing, with a continuous painful evocation of Diana's person, voice and movement, a statement of her moral imperfections, her levity and her extravagance. Then, with a keener longing still, and an absolute tenderness. As for Sir Joseph's proposition, he didn't care one way or another, and in any case he knew that there was little choice. Virtually none for him. He would go. And if past experience were still a guide, the naturalist within would revive in time. He would make vast collections. Huge areas would open to his view. His heart would beat again at the sight of new species, new genera of plants, birds and quadrupeds. And the Indies might provide some of those encounters with the enemy that wiped out everything but the extreme excitement of the contest. But was past experience still a guide? The stimulation of London and of all his meetings there died away as he travelled. and it was succeeded by an indifference greater than he'd ever known. In this grey state of mind, he arrived at Ashgrove Cottage. And there, since his indifference did not extend to his friend's concerns, he was instantly aware that something was amiss. His welcome was as kind as ever he could have wished, but Jack's weather and war-beaten face was even redder than usual. He was rather larger than life and taller, and there were traces of recent storms and their constrained behaviour to one another. Stephen was not very much surprised to learn that the new filly had shown a strange inability to run faster than others after the first three furlongs, and that she was given to crib-biting, jibbing, kicking, rearing, and wind-sucking, nor that a gang of Kimber's workmen had stoned his buzzard's nest, nor that Kimber himself was in disfavour for having made an unexpected and very costly revision of his estimates. But he was quite startled when Jack took him aside and told him that he was in a most hellfire rage with the Admiralty, was about to throw up the service, his flag be damned. He was used to their blackguardly ways, had suffered from them ever since he'd first worn the curse of God, but had never supposed they would presume to use him so, had never supposed they could be such shits as to tell him, without a moment's warning, that Leopard was to be used for transportation. "To a landsman," said Stephen, "this might seem a ship's prime function, its true raison d'etre." "No, no, what I mean is transportation," cried Jack. "So I had understood. The transportation of convicts. Convicts, Stephen, dodge my life. I am sent a letter in a damned crabbed hand telling me that I may expect a tender from the hulks. The hulks, in the name of all that's pure, with a score or so of assorted murderers that I'm to receive aboard and carry to Botany Bay. Orders ascending to the yard for the building of a cage in the forepeak and accommodation for their keepers. By God, Stephen, to expect an officer of my seniority to turn his ship into a transport and play the turnkey? I'm writing them such a letter. You must help me to some epithets, Stephen. And what really angers me is that Sophie doesn't seem able to grasp how monstrous their conduct is. I tell her it's a most improper proposal, but I wonder at their effrontery, and that I shall stick to Ajax, the new 74, a fine ship, with no flash Newgate colours lurking in the hold, but no. She sighs, says I know best, of course. And then 5 minutes later, there she is, crying up the Leopard, and what a delightful, interesting voyage it would be, and so comfortable with all my old shipmates and followers. Anyone would think she wished me away, out of the country as soon as possible. For Leopard's orders are advanced, and she sails on Saturday se'nnight. To an impartial mind, it is a little strange to see your dignity so offended by a score of prisoners. You, who have so willingly stuffed your holds with French and Spanish prisoners, to take such exception to a few of your own countrymen, whom you've always rated much higher than any foreigner, and who, in any case, would never be brought into contact with you, being under the conduct of proper persons. They're completely different. Prisoners of war and jailbirds are completely different. The deprivation of liberty is still the same. The subhuman, almost servile status. We have both been prisoners of war and prisoners for debt. We have both sailed with a number of men guilty of the most atrocious crimes. For my part, I have not found my dignity much affected. You, however, are to be the only judge of that. Yet I will observe, Jack, that a bird in the hand waits for no man, as you so often say yourself, and that the Ajax is at present little more than a naked keel. Who knows, by the time she floats, her occupation may be gone. She may sail on mere visits of courtesy, saluting the French colours with a blank discharge and a friendly cheer. "You don't mean there's danger of peace?" cried Jack, turning quick. "That's to say, I mean, the blessings of peace are very capital, nothing finer, but one likes to be warned." "I do not. I know nothing about it.
I only put it to you that the Ajax will not swim for another 6 months at the least, that there is something to be said for making hay when no clouds obscure the sun, and that it is your rolling stone that gets the worm.
Yes. Yes.
Very true, said Jack gravely. But that brings me to another point. 6 months would be very useful to me in the mining line, to get things in train, you understand. But far more important than that. You remember warning me about the raise? Stephen nodded. I could hardly credit it at the time, but you were right. I went to Craddock's while you were away. The judge was standing by, and only Andrew Ray, Carroll, Jennings, and a couple of their friends from Winchester sat down. I watched very closely after what you'd said, and although I couldn't make out what they were at, I saw that every time Ray drummed his fingers that way he has, I lost. I waited half a dozen times to make sure. The sixth time round, there was a very pretty penny on the table, and the signals were uncommon clear. I imitated them by way of taking notice of it to Ray and told him I didn't choose to play on those terms. "I do not understand you, sir," says he, and I believe he was on the point of making some fling about fellows that didn't love to lose, but thought better of it. I told him I should explain more clearly whenever he wished. Though, upon my word, I should have been hard put to it to tell who was receiving his signals. It might have been any man there. I should be sorry if it had been Carroll. I like him. But I must say he looked tolerably green about the gills. They all look tolerably green about the gills if it comes to that. But not a man jack of 'em spoke up when I asked whether any other gentleman wished to make an observation. It was an unpleasant moment, and I took it very friendly in Heneage Dundas to come quick across the room and stand by me. A damned unpleasant moment.
So Stephen Maturin imagined. But his imagination, though lively, fell far short of the full unpleasantness. Jack Aubrey's furious anger at finding himself a flat, a coney, a pigeon to be plucked, not to mention his honest rage at losing a very large sum of money, the silence in that big room filled with men of considerable rank and standing, when one of the most influential among them was openly, and in a very powerful voice, accused of cheating at cards, the silence in which many, having taken in the whole gravity of the situation, looked discreetly away, and which was broken by artificial conversation as Jack and Dundas walked out. Now Ray is on a tour of the dockyards, looking into corrupt practices, and he'll not be back for some considerable time. I didn't hear from him before he left, which is strange. But he cannot possibly sit down under this, and I don't wish to be out of the country when he returns. I do not wish to have the look of running off.
Ray will not fight you, said Stephen. If in a 12 hours go by after such an affront, he will not fight. He will have his satisfaction some other way.
I'm of your way of thinking, but I don't choose to let him whitewash himself by saying that I'm not to be found. Oh, come now, Jack. This is carrying it too far by a very long way, so it is. The world in general knows that service orders take precedence over everything else. Such an affair may certainly stand over for a year or more. We both know cases of the kind, and the absent man in no way reflected upon at all. Even so, I'd much rather give him all the time he needs for his tour and his... The arrival of Admiral Snape and Captain Hallowell to eat their mutton with the Aubreys cut the conversation short. But it was not a great while before Stephen was on the subject once again. Sophie had whispered him to join her early, and as the three sailors were intent upon fighting St. Vincent over again, shot by shot, it wasn't at all difficult for him to come away to the drawing-room while they were setting nutshells up in line of battle, and to come away with the certainty of a long, quiet interval before him. Sophie began by declaring that there was nothing on earth so wicked, barbarous and unchristian as the fighting of duels,
and they would be just as wicked even if the man who was in the wrong always lost, which was not the case. She spoke of young Mr. Butler of the Calliope, who was entirely innocent by all accounts, and who died of his wounds not a 12-month since. And Jane Butler, who had nursed him with all the love in the world, was left with 2 small children, and not a penny to feed them with. Nothing. Nothing, she said, clasping her hands and gazing at Stephen with huge, liquid eyes, could prevent Jack from standing up and being shot at or stabbed, so it was their absolute duty to make him go away in the Leopard. The ship couldn't be back for a great while, and in that time the whole thing would have blown over. Or that wretched Mr. Ray would have been brought to a better state of mind. Or perhaps... She hesitated. And Stephen said, or someone might knock him on the head first. It's not impossible. He frequents horse-racing men and card players, and he lives far above his income. The salary attached to his posts doesn't exceed £600 or £700 a year, and it doesn't appear that he has any estate, yet his turnout is that of a wealthy man. But after this, no one will feel inclined to play cards with him for anything but love, which makes such an event more unlikely than I could wish. On the other hand, I am intimately persuaded that Ray is not a fighting man. A fellow who will stomach such words for 12 hours will stomach them for 12 years, and digest them at last in his unlovely tomb. Honey, you have no need to trouble your mind upon my soul. Sophie couldn't share Stephen's intimate persuasion. Why did Jack have to say those words? She cried. Why couldn't he just have walked away? He ought to have thought of his children. And once again she urged her arguments against duelling, this time with an even greater vehemence, as though Stephen, in spite of his steady assurance that he was of the same opinion entirely, needed convincing. As though convincing Stephen would in some way help her cause. With any other person he would have been sadly bored, since for want of fresh arguments on this well-handled theme, she was obliged to reiterate those that had served abler minds this last 100 years. But he loved her much. Her beauty and her real distress moved him deeply, and he listened without the least impatience, nodding gravely. Then, after a pause for breath, for she habitually spoke with a charming volubility like a swallow in a barn, and now her words tumbled upon one another in a most surprising flow, she threw him out by saying, "Then, dear Stephen, since you are of the same mind with me, you must persuade him. You're so very much cleverer than I am that you'll find arguments quite out of my reach. You'll certainly persuade him. He thinks the world of your intelligence."
"Alas, my dear," said Stephen, sighing, "even if he did, which I must beg leave to doubt, in this matter intelligence is neither here nor there. Jack is no more of a fighting man than..." He was on the point of saying, "than I," but having a regard for truth when he was speaking to Sophie, he said, "than your parson here. He has too much sense. But since men have agreed this past age and more to exclude from their society those who refuse a challenge, his views have nothing to do with it. His hands are tied. Custom is everything, above all in the army and the navy. If he were to refuse, that would be the end of his career, and he could never live in comfort with himself."
"So to live comfortably, he must let himself be killed? Oh, what a world you men have made of it, Stephen," she said, groping for her handkerchief.
"Sophie Treasure, you're being womanish. You're being a blockhead. You will allow yourself to weep presently at this foolish rate of going on. You are to consider that very few rencounters result in so much as a scratch, if that. No, no, a great many of them are made up by a trifling redefinition of the words exchanged, or so managed by the seconds that they end with a few passes in the empty air or a pistol barely charged at all. Yet still I do think that Jack should be out of the way. I do think that he should go aboard this Leopard, sail off to the far side of the world, and stay there for a considerable time.
Do you, Stephen?
Said Sophie, eagerly searching his face.
I do so. He's behaving as I have seen so many sailors behave when they're ashore with a pocket full of guineas, and presently he too will be on his scuppers, as we say in the Navy. Running horses, cards, building, and even, God forbid, silver mining. All that lacks is a navigation canal at £10,000 a mile and the perpetual motion.
Oh, how glad I am that you've said this, cried Sophie.
I've been longing and longing to open my mind to you, but how can a woman possibly say anything about her husband's conduct, even to his best friend? But now you've spoken, I may reply, may I not, without being disloyal?
I'm not disloyal, Stephen, not in my least most secret thought, but it breaks my heart to see him flinging his fortune to the winds, earned so hard with such dreadful wounds, to see his dear, open, confiding, trustful nature imposed upon by vulgar card-sharpers and horse-racing men and projectors. It's like deceiving a child. And I hope it's not mercenary or interested in me when I say I must think of my babies. The girls have their portions, but how long they'll last I cannot tell. And as for George... One thing that Mama did teach me was keeping accounts. And when we were poor, I kept them to the farthing, so proud and happy when we could round the quarter clear of debt. Now it's very hard to see plain, with so many vast payments in and out, and with so many strange gaps. But at least I do know that there is much, much more out than in, and it cannot go on. I'm quite terrified sometimes. And sometimes, she added in a low voice, I have an even more terrifying thought. That he's not really happy on shore, and that he plunges into one wild, extravagant scheme after another to escape from a dull life in the country. And from a dull wife, too, perhaps. I do so want him to be happy. I've tried to learn astronomy like that Miss Herschel is always talking about, and who treats me as though I were a child, but it's no use. I still cannot understand why Venus changes shape.
"These are mere whimsies, my dear, vapours, megrims," said Stephen, dancing a covert glance at her. "And I see you must be let an ounce or two of blood. But for the rest, I believe you're right. Jack must go away, grow used to himself as a man of means, and learn to swim on an even keel when he's ashore again." There was no hint of unhappiness in the voice that came booming along the passage as Jack shepherded his flushed and vinous guests through the builders' ladders towards the drawing-room. But there was a touch of petulance and even doggedness to be heard some hours later when, pulling his nightcap firmly over his ears and tying the tapes, he replied, "Sweetheart, nothing on earth would induce me to accept the Leopard on those terms. So you might as well save your breath to cool your porridge."
"What porridge?"
"Why, porridge. Burgoo.
It's what people say when they mean to give you a hint that it's no use carping on the same string. Besides, there's a parcel of women to be sent into her, and you know very well that I've always abhorred women. Women are born, that's to say. They cause nothing but trouble and strife.
Sophie, do you mean to blow out the candle? Moths are coming in."
"I'm sure you're right, my dear, and I shall never for a moment presume to set my opinion against yours, above all in anything to do with the service." Sophie was well acquainted with her husband's power of going instantly to sleep, and of staying asleep whatever the circumstances. And at this point, taking particular care of the carpet, she flung down the candlestick, sconce, and extinguisher. Jack leapt out of bed, put all to rights, and she continued, "But there is just one thing that I must say, because with all this hurry and unpleasantness, and the fencibles and the builders, you may not have seen it quite as I do. There's Stephen to be considered, and his sad disappointment."
"But Stephen cried off in the first place. Heartbroken, said he, but he almost certainly couldn't come, and never a word has he said since he returned.
Heartbroken he is, I'm very sure. He doesn't say so, but it's as clear as the day that Diana's wounded him again. You had but to look at his poor face when he came back from town. My dear, we owe Stephen a great deal. A voyage to Botany Bay would do him all the good in the world. The peace and the quiet and all those new creatures to keep his mind from dwelling on her. Do but imagine him brooding for months and months in some horrid lodgings until the Ajax is launched. He would mope away and eat himself up with misery. Lord Servy, perhaps there may be something in what you say. I was so taken up with this damn business of Kimber and the leopard and my letter to the Admiralty that I hardly considered. Of course, I saw he looked hipped, and I supposed she'd played him some vile trick. But he never gave me so much as a hint of it. He never said, my affairs don't run as smooth as I could wish in a certain quarter, so I'll go with you in the leopard. Or, Jack, I could do with a change of climate, I could do with a tropical climate. I should have smoked that instantly.
Stephen is far too delicate.
Once he'd seen that you had changed your mind about the ship, he would never mention his own concerns. But if you had heard him speak of wombats, oh, just in passing and not with any sense of ill usage, it would have brought tears to your eyes. Oh, Jack, he's so very low.